Chapter 6. Quote, "Now there was nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding. And all the devils besought him, saying, Send us into the swine, that we may enter into them. And forthwith Jesus gave them leave." End quote. Mark chapter 5, verses 11 through 13. Trying to work on the Ishikido manuscript with Jack in the room was like trying to conjugate irregular Dardic verbs while a large, angry hornet buzzed around his head. Okay, it was more like trying to work with a hornet perched on the corner of his desk. Said hornet trying really, really hard not to be large or angry. "Jack," he started to say for the third or fourth, or maybe it was the 20th time. "No, Daniel. You don't even know what..." "I'm not leaving. Deal with it." Daniel scowled in exasperation, and Jack smiled back sweetly. Not bad for a man who was completely freaked out. Daniel could hardly blame him for that. He was pretty much completely freaked out himself, though he was trying really hard not to think about it. There was obviously no use wondering if mankind's time was already up, if they were already trapped in a nightmare from which none of them would ever awaken. One good thing. If mankind were history, then so were the Goa'uld. Them, and pretty much every other sentient species in the galaxy. It was quite a thought. All culture, all knowledge, every fragment of beauty that every race anywhere had ever preserved from the fire of existence. Lost forever. Yeah, it was something to think about, all right. Especially if you wanted to go utterly insane. Cuneiform danced across the delicate green alabaster, and Daniel threw his pen across the room as hard as he could, and then immediately regretted it. "All right," Jack said calmly. "That's it for tonight." "I can't stop." Daniel played at being just as calm, with rather less success, he knew. "There isn't time." "And just how much progress have you made in the last 3 hours?" Since the honest answer to that would be none, Daniel said, "I'm certainly not going to make any while I'm sleeping back at the hotel." Wesley stuck his head in the door. "Everything all right? Do you need anything?" What Daniel needed was for Jack and Wesley to sit down and talk about which local occultists might have the resources and sheer recklessness to have translated the Ishikido manuscript, because it was abundantly clear to Daniel this was exactly the sort of thing that the SGC knew absolutely nothing about, whereas Wesley and friends probably knew quite a lot. Jack, however, was immovable. Daniel wasn't to say a word about the implications of his translation to the employees and hanger-ons, or whatever the hell they were, of Angel Investigations. "We're fine, thanks," Jack told Wesley without hesitation. "In fact, Dr. Jackson here is ready to call it a night." "Jack, I really think okay with you if we show up in the morning around 8? Get an early start." Wesley glanced from Daniel to Jack. "Yes, yes, I suppose, of course. Whatever you like." "Good man." Jack clapped him on the shoulder. "You've been a big help today, and we'll see you in the morning. Daniel, want to pack it up?" Daniel was still trying to decide whether he wanted to argue the point. Right, he was exhausted and distracted and making no progress at all on the translation. But on the other hand, considering what was at stake here, how could he possibly break for the night? Then Jack's cell phone began to ring. O'Neill. He looked at Daniel and Wesley. Glad to hear it. See you in half an hour, 45 minutes, depending on traffic. You have friends in town, Wesley said flatly as Jack put the phone away. Will they be here in the morning as well? It's possible. You don't have a problem with that, do you? Wesley looked to Daniel. Obviously, he did have a problem. We wouldn't ask if this weren't so important, Daniel said. Do you know yet if the manuscript actually relates to the appearance of the Tattered King, the apparent slippage of dimensions we all observed last night? Daniel couldn't lie to the man, so he held his tongue, unhappily, and let Jack do it. Dr. Jackson doesn't know anything for certain. Archaic Sumerian is an extremely difficult language, you know. Wesley didn't answer out loud, but what he would have liked to say was written clear on his face. Jack, we need to trust these people. You're making a mistake by keeping them in the dark. The Los Angeles skyline was fading from gaudy orange to ashen gray, the moon rising pallid behind the streetlights.
Do you think it would be faster to drop down to La Cienega, or just take sunset all the way out?
I don't know. Sunset, probably. But I'm serious about this. Depending on Jim Ellison to... Well, I don't know. Sense? The people responsible for this, when we could just ask Wesley.
Sunset it is, Jack said, turning left onto Highland.
Look, Daniel, has it occurred to you that the entire weird menagerie calling itself Angel Investigations could be responsible for what's happening themselves? You don't really believe that. I don't know whether I believe anything right now, but these are the people who've had physical possession of that green rock for the past 6 months. Wyndham Price is naive at best, Gunn and Chase are children, and trust me, there's something seriously up with that angel character.
You're just unhappy with the idea of a grown man calling himself Angel. Daniel scrubbed at his forehead, wishing he had remembered to wash off the eyeliner before leaving. He imagined he could feel the weight of the signs on his skin, itching like old scars.
Well, I'm not happy with... Jesus!
Daniel felt it too, a stomach-drop sense of vertigo, like using a ring transporter or topping the hill of a roller coaster.
What the hell was that? Jack exclaimed furiously.
He never lost control of the car, but most of the drivers around them didn't have Jack's reflexes. Daniel heard brakes squealing behind them and the sickening crump of metal. A driver in front swerved into oncoming traffic and was struck so hard her car spun in a full circle and ended up on its side halfway off the curb, wheels spinning madly. Car alarms began to wail all around them, and somewhere nearby, a man was screaming in rage or pain. Jack got very calm and very quiet as he tried to maneuver out of traffic, but both sides of the street were parked bumper to bumper, and there was nowhere to go. Then, Daniel saw what was coming towards them.
Oh my God!
It's not real. Jack said tightly. There's no fucking way that could be real. There were pigs in the road. Massive, bloated beasts, each so tremendous it could hardly support its own body weight, lumbering on hooves that smacked the pavement with a flat, ringing sound. Their heads were malformed, But it wasn't until the impossible herd drew closer, Daniel could tell how. The pigs had human faces. Jack made a choke sound of disgust and gunned the engine. Daniel flung out his arm, shouting, "Jack, no!" But he was already too late. The faces seemed to leap forward, cramming themselves against the windshield. The impact smashed Daniel forward into the violently expanding airbag and then sideways against the car door. Something red blotted out everything except Daniel's realization that the nightmare was already here. He couldn't see Jack, and he couldn't hear him. There was only the red universe and messy, breath-stealing jolts of pain. He tried to call Jack, but couldn't hear his own voice over the squeal of his nerve endings. Then something snapped sharply through Daniel's fog. Someone had opened the car door and released his seatbelt. Daniel couldn't see his rescuer, but the reminder of blessedly ordinary things like car doors and seatbelts cleared some of his shock. And this time, when he turned his head, he could finally see Jack. The airbag had pinned him against the seat back, and his head was turned towards Daniel, eyes blinking open. "Hey," Jack whispered hoarsely. He took a deep breath, shuddering. "You hurt?" "No," Daniel lied ridiculously. Then he said, "Yeah, think maybe..." Talking was an effort. He searched for individual words as though they were copper coins resting on the bottom of a shallow, muddy pond. "I don't know. Maybe dislocated my shoulder?" The lines around Jack's eyes deepened as he winced. "Fuck, Danny, that'll hurt like a son of a bitch." "Yeah." His voice rose out of his control, and he was pretty sure he must be going into shock. "Actually, it does." He swallowed back either tears or laughter. "How bad are you?" And suddenly Daniel found himself being dragged out of the rental car. His shoulder hit the side of the door, and the sludgy red pain flared up like a wildfire. He dropped to his knees, his right arm hanging uselessly at his side, hearing Jack shout after him. "Jack's hurt," Daniel pleaded. "Please get him out. There were pigs in the road."
"Things are getting pretty goddamn strange," agreed someone who was standing above him, maybe one of the same people who then proceeded to grab him under both arms and haul him to his feet. Daniel couldn't breathe through the pain. "As a matter of fact, Dr. Jackson, that's really what we wanted to talk to you about."
Quote, "When I, the goddess, was walking around in heaven, walking around on earth, when I, Inanna, was walking around in heaven, walking around on earth, when I was walking around in Elam and Subir, when I was walking around in the Lulubi Mountains, when I turned towards the center of the mountains, as I, the goddess, approached the mountain, it showed me no respect. As I, Inanna, approached the mountain, it showed me no respect. As I approached the mountain range of Abba, it showed me no respect. Since they showed me no respect, since they did not put their noses to the ground for me, since they did not rub their lips in the dust for me, I shall fill the soaring mountain range with my terror." End quote. Inanna and Abba. "They're coming back tomorrow," Angel repeated flatly. "With reinforcements."
Friends, Wesley corrected, but his heart wasn't really in it. Jack said they were friends.
Right.
Wesley, I don't trust O'Neill and Jackson as it is. I certainly don't trust any of their so-called friends sight unseen.
Oh, I don't know, Gunn shrugged.
Jack seems okay.
Let me ask you something. So Dr. Jackson is this brilliant linguist. In fact, you told me this morning that if anyone could translate the Ishikido manuscript, he was our man. So how many hours did he spend on it today? 10? More?
Something like that, Wesley agreed unhappily.
And how much more do we know about this green rock than when he started this morning?
Wesley's lips tightened.
I think Daniel may have made quite a bit of progress on his translation, but... Jack wouldn't allow him to tell me anything substantial.
I don't like this at all. Do you know what's happening at Caritas right now?
You've been to Caritas.
And he didn't invite us, Gunn said.
That's cold, man.
The host is gone.
Gone? Wesley asked, startled.
For good?
He left right after last night's psychic mess. Patrons at Caritas saw the tattered man without a face just like we did, and as soon as it was over, and while people were still picking themselves off the floor, the host announced that the door had shut for good.
The door? Gunn said.
What door?
Exactly what you think. No more soul readings, no more showing people their path. Like his access to the higher powers just ended.
Oh my God! Wesley found his way to one of the lobby sofas and sat down heavily.
Cordelia!
Angel crossed his arms over his chest.
Exactly. She hasn't had a vision in weeks either.
So this has been building all along.
Wesley looked shaken to the core. Right under our very noses, and none of us even noticed.
Under the circumstances, I don't think I'm willing to allow Jackson and O'Neill any further access to the manuscript until they agree to produce some answers.
Yes, that's probably...
Wesley trailed off distractedly.
I just don't understand. What in the name of heaven could have such a profound impact on the higher planes?
Magics on that level would threaten the very foundations of our own reality.
Hey, 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 Gunn interrupted.
All we've really got going on here is a karaoke bar closing down and the fact that Cordy has been kind of light in the visions department lately.
Seems like pretty flimsy evidence to be predicting the end of the world.
The world answered Gunn by taking a hard turn to the left.
Angel felt it in the soles of his feet and in the vulnerable chambers of his heart. He felt it between his temples, where unfathomably ancient demon magic had kept neurons firing for centuries after every axon and dendrite should have turned to dust. This was older still. Wesley's eyes had gone blank with a kind of stupefied horror. He stumbled to his feet as Gunn swore and backed away, and Angel wondered if they saw what he did. The walls of the Hyperion, shimmering and translucent, and beyond them, nothing at all. Not even the sun. Not even stars. He put his hands over his face, but his fingers hid nothing, and when he dropped his hands, he was alone in a neglected garden.
Weeds grew rank on both sides of the broken stone path. The roses were thick as brambles, their sparse flowers rotten and half-devoured by worms. Oily black water lay motionless in a cracked cistern, and the marble nymph who presided over the fountain was faceless and armless. A bubble broke the surface of the water as Angel passed by, releasing the foul smell of decay. Around a turn in the path, past a sad thicket of hawthorn and laurel, Angel came upon a man sitting in a plain wooden chair. His back was to Angel, his head down, and he didn't respond when Angel called to him. Angel hesitated then for a long moment, but the loneliness of the garden ultimately propelled him forward. A mist clung to the ground, obscuring his view, and he was very close before he realized the stranger was bound, hands tied to the back of the chair with thin, coarse rope. The fingers had been twisted into broken claws. The cuffs of his shirt were soaked black with blood. Branches rustled in the undergrowth, and something burst outwards in a rush of wings and disappeared into the mist. "Giles," Angel said, because he recognized the tortured man now. Shame twisted in his gut like curdled blood. But this was such an old pain, he all but welcomed it in this strange landscape. At least it was something familiar. "You're safe now. I'll take you home." He put his hand on the man's shoulder before realizing this wasn't Giles at all. Surprised and vaguely angry at having the one recognizable element in this nightmare snatched away from him, he yanked down the blindfold hiding the stranger's face and found Dr. Jackson blinking up at him. "Where are we?" Angel demanded. "What's happening?" Wesley's prize linguist blinked again, vague and unfocused.
"I don't know," he said. "Help me."
Angel leaned in close.
"Help you? You come in here with no idea what you're doing. You fuck up reality, and now you want me to help you?"
The anger felt good, untangling the tendrils of fear that had begun to wind their way up his spine. Angel had already spent one eternity in hell, and this dark garden reminded him all too vividly of its outlying regions. He wrapped his hand around Dr. Jackson's broken fingers and savored the way the bound man tensed. "You tell me what's going on, and maybe I'll kill you quickly," Angel promised. Then he put his mouth over Daniel Jackson's as he tightened his grip and drank the man's screams like blood. When Angel raised his head, he was in the lobby of the Hyperion. Sirens were shrieking in the street, and the chandeliers overhead were dark. Gunn was watching him with a face as neutral as he could manage, but Wesley had turned away.
"Jackson?"
Angel muttered at last.
"He's not here, man," Gunn said. "It wasn't real."
"You saw," Angel said in a dull voice. "And you still think I'm no danger to anyone?" He curled one hand into a fist, remembering the feel of broken bones grinding together and the heady, sour taste of terror and pain. "How many warnings do you think we're going to get before it is real?"
"Damn it, Angel," Wesley whirled around. "We have no time for your brooding self-pity right now. Do you hear what's going on outside? The ordinary world just came apart at the seams, and I don't know how well it got put back together again. We've got to find out what's happening, and we have to keep it from happening again. Do you understand me?"
Angel shook his head, although he did understand.
Where's Cordelia?
She should be at that damn dress rehearsal. Wesley pulled out his cell phone and tried to dial.
Nothing.
Gunn picked up the phone at the front desk. Regular phone lines are down, too.
Then we'll drive, Angel said decisively, even though he could still smell the stagnant water in the cistern, still hear wings beating in the underbrush.
You have an address?
It should be on the tickets, Wesley said.
Angel, I'm sure she gave them to you.
That was weeks ago, Angel protested, sorting hurriedly through the mail stacked on the reception desk.
Gunn whistled through his teeth.
You lost Cordy's tickets. Oh, man, maybe you better hope the world ends after all.
Angel didn't bother to respond, yanking open file drawers and pulling out folders as though he really expected to find one labeled Cordelia's Show Tickets.
It was more unreal than the ruined garden, trying to find theater tickets while sirens screamed on the streets outside.
The light was failing as dusk gave way to night. Before long, it would be too dark for Wesley and Gunn to see anything in here.
Have we got flashlights? He asked, pulling open the bottom file drawer.
You two better find them while you can still see.
Already on it, Gunn announced, and a light stabbed through the shadowy recesses of the lobby.
Wait a minute. Wesley spread a newspaper out on the desk.
I've got it. It should be in the weekly's opening shows, right? Here it is.
Gunn shone the flashlight over Wesley's shoulder. The Inanna Theater Group, corner of Santa Monica and Robertson.
I hope she has the good sense to stay put until we get there, Angel growled.
Blue police lights were crawling up the walls of the dark lobby.
The Inanna Theater, Wesley repeated thoughtfully.
I know that name, Angel said.
You should.
A major Sumerian deity, goddess of the morning and evening star.
Not a surprising name for an avant-garde theater group, I suppose.
Just an interesting coincidence after Dr. Jackson spent the whole day here trying to translate a Sumerian text, isn't it?
What are you suggesting?
Nothing, I honestly don't know. If we had more time... The front doors slammed open.
We don't have time. They've taken Daniel.
Jack?
Gunn half ran to the front doors, catching Jack O'Neill when he staggered and helping him in over the threshold.
Come in. It's all right.
It's not all right, Jack protested, but he allowed Gunn to help him to a chair and fell into it heavily, the palm of one hand pressed hard against his forehead.
You're hurt, Wesley said.
It's a madhouse out there.
Jack tried to get to his feet, but collapsed again with a groan.
They grabbed Daniel right in front of me.
Who grabbed him? Gunn asked.
Jack turned his head slowly.
Who do you think?
The words came out as a hiss, and Angel felt the hairs on the back of his neck standing on end.
Jack's face shifted in the shadows.
Blue light from a cop car passing on the street glinted on his canines, one point lying on Jack's lower lip and glistening with spit. Angel lunged forward, knowing it was impossible and wrong. There hadn't been nearly enough time for the transformation, the dark resurrection. Gunn must have known it was impossible too, but he acted on sheer instinct. In less than the space of a breath, he pulled a stake from his coat and plunged it into Jack's chest. Angel grabbed Gunn's shoulder and flung him violently away. But he'd already heard the wet implosion as wood pierced the walls of Jack's heart. The reek of blood dazzled him as it spilled into Jack's chest cavity. Jack blinked in surprise. He opened his mouth as if to speak, then died.
No. Gunn staggered, fumbling with the flashlight and then shining it on the dead man on the sofa. Jack's eyes still looked surprised.
No, he said again. I saw the face. His motherfucking teeth, for Christ's sake.
You were wrong, Wesley said, his voice flat as he tried to contain his emotion.
Gunn stumbled back, and then his legs simply folded up under him.
Then Angel felt reality bump, like a change of reel at the movies. Colors shifted slightly, the blues becoming darker, the red from an ambulance's siren flashing more sharply across the windows. Sounds became more nuanced, and Jack O'Neill no longer lay dead on their sofa. Apparently, he'd never been there at all.
Gunn breathed, "Oh, fuck, man," and buried his head in his hands.
He made no move to get up from the floor.
"I don't think," Wesley started to say, but his voice wavered beyond the limits of control.
He swallowed hard and tried again.
"I don't know how much more of this I can take."
"You were the one who told me we didn't have time for self-pity," Angel said, not harshly.
"We have to get to Cordelia.
I think we also have to find Jackson and O'Neill."
Wesley looked at him, face drawn in the shadows.
"Yes, of course," he said eventually.
"Gunn, there's a chance Cordelia may try to make her way back here. The same with Daniel and Jack. Will you be all right waiting here while Angel and I go out looking for them?"
Gunn raised his head.
"How should I know? Would one of you please tell me how, in the name of Jesus, I'm supposed to know what's real? I just fucking killed a man."
"I don't know," Wesley said. "I can feel it when it starts, and there's some kind of, I don't know how to describe it, a kind of shuddery feeling inside when it's all over. But when it's actually happening, I don't know. It all feels real, and I can't control my reactions."
"No shit," Gunn said.
"We have to go," Angel repeated.
"Yeah, go. I'll be all right. Probably kill anyone stupid enough to stick their head in the door, but hey, I'll be okay."
"Charles," Wesley said, and put his hand on Gunn's shoulder. Gunn shook himself free.
"Get the hell out of here and find Cordy."
As it turned out, though, they found O'Neill first, pinned behind the steering wheel of a wrecked Ford Taurus, barely 5 blocks away. Wesley recognized the rental car, and Angel recognized the smell of his blood. Whatever was happening when reality skipped a beat, Angel was sure it was far closer to prophecy than hallucination, regardless of what Wesley wanted to believe.
"They grabbed Daniel," O'Neill said as soon as Angel wrenched the car door open. "You've got to get in touch with Major Samantha Carter. She should be at the Sands Hotel in Santa Monica."
"Just a moment," Wesley interrupted him, shooting a look at Angel. "Let's get you out of here first. Are you hurt?"
"What do you think? I'm just sitting here for my goddamn health while a bunch of goons drag Daniel..."
A police helicopter drowned out the rest of O'Neill's furious snarl. There were no streetlights, and the streets were bumper to bumper with frightened, angry drivers. Angel nodded to Wesley, not bothering to yell over the roar of the helicopter, and together they tried to lift O'Neill out from behind the wheel. As soon as they started pulling, O'Neill's head went back, and a noisy sob of pain escaped him.
"Son of a bitch!"
Wesley knelt and reached his hand up under the steering wheel.
His ankle's trapped, he shouted up to Angel. See if you can get him out.
There's no time for this, Jack panted.
The helicopter was moving away overhead.
Call Major Carter. My cell phone's broken, but you...
Nobody's phones are working, Wesley told him. I'm sorry. He changed places with Angel, who felt around the broken floorboards and crumpled dash until he found the cage of smashed plastic and vinyl, like teeth, around O'Neill's right ankle. His sock was sticky with blood.
Got it, Angel muttered, bending away the shards.
Okay, Wesley, see if you can get him out now, he said, and tried to protect the damaged flesh around his ankle with his hands as Wesley pulled O'Neill out. He was still feeling a disorienting shimmer of déjà vu, as though helping O'Neill now made up for not being fast enough to save him 10 minutes ago. He got up as soon as O'Neill was free and helped Wesley lower him to the sidewalk, his back against the flat front tire of the rental car. O'Neill was alternately swearing and hissing in pain through clenched teeth.
No phones!
He finally managed to grit out. Wesley shook his head. What happened to Dr. Jackson?
I didn't see it, Jack burst out furiously. Just heard him. He was shouting for me. God damn it. We have to get to Carter. Do you have a car?
Wesley looked back at Angel. We do, but Jack, before we go anywhere, I think Angel and I both need to know if the things that are happening now are related to Dr. Jackson's translation of the Ishikido manuscript. O'Neill glared at both of them, dark eyes flashing with the reflection of passing headlights.
How bad's the ankle?
He demanded instead of answering Wesley's question.
I can't tell in this light, Wesley said. How does it feel? Like it's smashed to hell and gone.
Jack rested the back of his head against the side of the car and closed his eyes for a long moment.
Just like this whole planet's gonna be if you people don't help me find Daniel Jackson.
Quote, the Shimunda grass is a fire carrier. He cannot be tied into bundles. The grass cannot be shifted. The grass cannot be loosened. The grass cannot be loosened. Having kindled a fire, he spreads it wide. The Shimunda grass's habitat is among his bitter waters. He butts about, saying, I will start a fire. End quote. The Shimunda grass, late 3rd millennium to the early 2nd millennium BCE. They'd dutifully gone to the Indian restaurant Colonel O'Neill recommended, but Tilk and Jim Ellison were the only ones with any real appetite. Blair Sandberg still looked like hell, pushing the doll he'd ordered around in his bowl with the back of his spoon, and insisting, every time he caught Jim watching him with worried eyes, that he was fine and the food was great. Major Davis was still looking pretty green from the flight as well. At least in his case, Sam was willing to admit he might actually be airsick, especially after that greasy falafel plate in Cascade. He was nursing a pale ale and unobtrusively checking his watch, probably wondering if they should head back to the hotel to meet Jack. He checked his watch again, looked at Jim and Blair, then across the table at Tilk, who was scooping up his curried potatoes with the rest of the naan, and then he noticed that Sam was watching him. Davis shrugged slightly, not quite smiling. A diplomatic apology for being a little fidgety, Sam supposed, and reached for the beer he wasn't really drinking. Then he stopped. He stared at his glass for a moment, then up at Sam. Major, he said,
Do you... The liquid in the glass was moving, sloshing very gently to and fro. Earthquake. This was L.A., after all. Except Sam knew something deeper than the earth was shuddering around them. She tried to shout a warning, but Blair cried out Jim's name in anguish, and everything was already over and done with. The lone and level sands of P3X-636 stretched as far as the sluggish gray ocean. The terrible ruins rose on the other side, incomprehensibly vast. Sam took one step and went crashing to her knees. Colonel O'Neill had been right all along. The vertigo wasn't caused by the scale of this place or the thin atmosphere. They couldn't find their balance because something old as the universe had slept here for millennia. "Oh, Daniel," she thought, trying again to get to her feet and instead falling heavily to her side as the sky spun around her. "What have you done?" "Please," Daniel repeated, keeping his voice very calm and level and his breathing shallow and controlled. "Just let me go back long enough to make sure Jack's all right. Then I'll do whatever you want, but I have to know Jack's okay first." The men sitting on either side of Daniel didn't even look at him. They were big guys in tailored suits, receivers in their ears, and shoulder holsters under their coats. Daniel tried again. "Look, whatever you want from me, you're not going to get it until I know Jack's all right. He could be bleeding. He could have internal injuries. And as crazy as everything is out there right now, it might be hours before anyone stops to help." Nothing. The big sedan was inching its way through the chaotic streets at a snail's pace. Daniel thought they were traveling roughly eastward, but when these well-dressed goons had first dragged him into the car, his shoulder had been hurting so badly he hadn't been able to keep track of direction. Dusk had given way to night, and the only light came from car headlights. Apparently, no giant pigs had made a reappearance, though at this point he didn't know if that was necessarily a good thing or not. Daniel's hands were secured in front of himself with plastic restraints, and the pain in his shoulder had spread all the way down his ribcage and across his back. When he thought about it too much, his chest began to seize up, so he was panting shallowly and trying to stay very calm. He told himself irritably that nobody had ever suffocated to death from a dislocated shoulder. Still, not being able to draw a deep breath frightened him in a way that just wasn't susceptible to rational thought. "I don't care who you are, you don't have any right to do this," he declared. Shallow breaths, one after another. "You can't hold me against my will. In fact, I'm going back to make sure Jack's all right, and I'm doing it right now." He might as well have been a fly crawling along the seat for the reaction that garnered from the big guys on either side. "Fine. Enough of this." They couldn't have been traveling at more than 10 miles per hour. Car horns were blatting from all directions, and an ambulance or a police car had been trapped in traffic along with them for the past 5 minutes, its siren wailing futilely. Hoping it was the police and that they happened to be looking in this direction, Daniel suddenly lunged across the guy on his right, reaching desperately for the door handle. The sudden movement made his shoulder feel like it was exploding, but the handle began to yield under his fingers, and that was all that mattered. "Jack," he thought like a prayer,
before a fist knotted in the back of his shirt collar and dragged him back. Daniel twisted, trying to fight, but the big guy on his left simply punched him in the side with one quick, economical blow, and the guy on his right put the heel of his beefy, manicured hand against Daniel's dislocated shoulder and gently pushed a little. Daniel stopped fighting. He would have screamed, but his lungs didn't work anymore. Apparently, nothing worked. He doubled over, the entire world reduced to a smear of carmine red.
"Agent Stoffel was a friend of mine," exploded a harsh whisper against his ear. "So go ahead. Try something like that again."
Unable to speak or move, tears wet on his cheeks and his heart thudding against his ribcage like a sledgehammer, Daniel wondered who the hell Agent Stoffel had been. It took Wesley a few moments to understand. He thought it was the final dregs of sunset until he realized he was looking southwards. He smelled ash in the wind at the same time. "Oh my God," he said. "Those are fires."
"Looks like that's probably around Crenshaw, maybe a little further east." Angel shook his head. "They're still trying to get rebuilt from the last time."
"Christ," Jack muttered from the back seat. "This is insane."
Wesley could hardly disagree, but he ventured, "They might not have been set deliberately. A broken gas main or just accidental fires. And with resources stretched so thin, the fire department can't get out there."
"Or people think it's the end of the world and they want to take a piece of Los Angeles down with them," Angel said.
"The people who grabbed Daniel are getting further away the longer we screw around here,"
O'Neill complained, a ragged edge to his voice.
"They're trapped in the same gridlock we are, so they're not getting anywhere very damn fast," Angel growled back. "We'll get you to the rest of your friends as soon as we pick up Cordelia. Do you have any idea who would want to kidnap Dr. Jackson?"
When Jack didn't answer, Wesley looked back at him. His face was ashen in the light of the passing headlights. He sat sideways, his right leg stretched awkwardly out along the seat. Wesley had wrapped the ankle in gauze to staunch the bleeding, then used an ace bandage to stabilize the joint. It was all Wesley knew to do for him until they could get him to a doctor. Cordelia was the one who had nagged Angel into carrying a first aid kit in the trunk in the first place, and Wesley felt slightly sick with worry for her. Angel wasn't saying anything out loud, but he didn't need to. Wesley knew Angel was remembering the images from the L.A. riots, just the way he was.
"Please let Cordy be all right."
"You'd know that better than I would," Jack finally said, sounding as though he'd come to a decision.
"I'm sorry. Know what?"
"Know who would go after Daniel. This afternoon, Daniel told me he thought someone had already managed to translate at least some of the manuscript. Someone who was now trying to perform the ritual it describes." It wasn't really a surprise, but Wesley felt a little breathless all the same. What would be the consequences of performing the ritual? Jack sighed heavily.
"Bad," he said. "Daniel thought the consequences would be very, very bad."
Angel made an encompassing gesture with the hand that wasn't on the steering wheel.
"As bad as this?"
"Yeah," Jack said. "That bad."
You think the people who took Daniel are the same ones who are responsible for all this? Wesley worked his way through the scraps of information, slowly and carefully, and they started to tumble together like puzzle pieces falling into place. But whoever they are, they didn't expect this degree of chaos, did they? Now they've taken Daniel in order to clean up their translation and figure out what went wrong.
So who are they?
Angel demanded.
I could be wrong, but I get the impression people who can read archaic Sumerian at all, even badly, aren't exactly falling off the trees around here.
See, that's what Daniel thought you people would know, Jack said impatiently. His tone implied this was all somehow Angel's fault.
You make it your business, don't you? People who believe in things. Vampires and demons and magic pixie dust. Daniel thought you would know who would want to translate this and would actually have the ability to do it.
Angel turned his head just enough to catch Wesley's eye. They were on the same page here. Wolfram and Hart had the resources to pick up every Sumerian scholar in the hemisphere. Then Angel maneuvered the Plymouth through a gap in traffic and managed the left-hand turn that he'd been trying to make for the last 10 minutes. Wesley looked up and forgot all about Ancient Sumerian.
Ah, hell, Jack said. You've got to be kidding me.
The driver said, "The door's not opening." The big guy on Daniel's left swore, and the one on his right said, "We could have a code red on our hands. Contact team leader at..." "Oh, wait a minute," the driver interrupted. "There's no power. That's why the garage door won't open." The guy on the right swore again, and Daniel was strongly tempted to laugh, but he couldn't summon the energy or the breath.
"We'll have to take him in through the lobby," said the guy on his left.
And suddenly a gun was pressed to Daniel's throat. The muzzle was warm from the body heat of the man holding it.
"If you say a single word, we'll kill the person you're talking to. Understand me?"
"You don't need to hurt anybody," Daniel said. The guy on his right let his hand rest on Daniel's shoulder, and Daniel groaned in pain.
"Just answer the question, do you understand?"
Daniel clenched his jaw and held out as long as he could, pointless as it was. When the man on his right began to dig his fingers into the swelling around Daniel's shoulder, though, he burst out shakily,
"I understand. Damn it. Just don't hurt anybody." "Thank you, Dr. Jackson."
Daniel's tormentor released him. The pain throbbed across the tensed muscles in his chest and down his back, and Daniel concentrated on breathing until the car doors opened and he was dragged out into the night. The big sedan was parked in front of a gated underground garage under a 3-story condominium. Daniel could see the square outline of the roof against a night brilliant with stars. From the sound of traffic, he thought they were probably only a half block or so from a major road, maybe Hollywood or Sunset Boulevard, and given their rate of travel, probably no more than a mile away from the wrecked rental car and Jack. The urge to simply start running, trusting to the darkness of the night and the element of surprise, was almost irresistible. But one of his captors took his elbow in a firm grip, jostling his shoulder, and Daniel went to his knees with a gasp. He was yanked to his feet again, and the pain was so extraordinary, everything blurred in his mind. For a few moments, he was convinced Aminette held him pinned in the light of a hand device, though for some reason she had trained it on his shoulder instead of his forehead.
Tilk, he muttered desperately. Don't, please don't. Shari won't hurt me.
Then he opened his eyes and looked up into a granite face that absolutely wasn't Teal'c's.
You try a stunt like that while we're going through the lobby and I'll have to shoot the doorman.
Daniel shook his head, meaning, please don't shoot the doorman. And though he was crying a little from the shock of memory, he was so angry the red heat of his rage was more disorienting than the pain of a dislocated shoulder. They had no right to do this. He was staggering as they led him up the walk, then up a low flight of stairs. Through double-paned glass doors, Daniel could see a Coleman lantern sitting on a reception desk, its inadequate yellow light throwing dark shadows into the corners of the room. Daniel tried to straighten his spine, as though walking straight and tall could possibly hide the fact that his hands were cuffed together. The doorman had apparently been waiting for them and swung the door open.
Cart keys won't work without power, he announced, sounding almost cheerful. Neither will the elevators, actually.
Not a problem, said one of Daniel's captors. Dr. Jackson here can walk.
You sure?
The doorman shone a flashlight directly into Daniel's face.
Looks like he's not in the best of shape.
Daniel forced himself to smile, but didn't dare speak, holding his breath and praying that the man wouldn't train the flashlight downward toward his cuffed hands. But then the doorman said,
you two been roughing him up. The way I heard it, you weren't supposed to harm a hair on his head.
Not our fault. We pulled him out of a wrecked car down on Highland.
Tell him, Dr. Jackson. We haven't laid a hand on you, have we?
Daniel closed his eyes. Far as I know, no one's ever even asked him what happened to those agents up on Blewett Pass, said one of his captors.
Johnny Stoffel was the man who recruited me, and no one's ever heard from him again. We lost a lot of good men up there, and if it was up to me, I promise you, Daniel Jackson would be singing like a bird before morning.
A hand fell on his shoulder again, and brilliant flashes of light exploded across his retinas.
By the way, Dr. Jackson, I suppose you can talk to the doorman if you want to, after all.
Daniel was trembling in rage and pain. But he didn't speak and didn't resist as his captors walked him up a flight of stairs and down a short hallway. Mostly he was trying not to trip because falling would have hurt so damned much. But he heard the doorman behind him talking on a phone or two-way radio. He couldn't make out the words. The light of two flashlights bounced along bare white walls and closed doors. As they reached the door at the end of the hall, it opened for them, and another big guy in a suit said,
any word on when we'll be getting the power back?
You could try asking Dr. Jackson.
Daniel was pushed through the door and found himself in a plainly appointed room that looked more like a reception area than anyone's home. A battery-powered lantern stood on an end table, and there was a man sitting in a chair against the far wall. It was too dark for Daniel to see his face.
But so far all he can do is whine about his sugar daddy getting left behind.
You don't have O'Neill?
Daniel felt hot and cold at once, weak-kneed with relief that Jack had been left behind.
We didn't have any orders regarding Colonel O'Neill.
And it didn't occur to you that he'd be useful, asked the first man, incredulous.
Never mind, we've got people in position.
The man in the shadows still hadn't spoken. Daniel was shoved into a chair, and both his ankles were secured to the legs of the chair with two more plastic cuffs. Then all three of the big men in suits disappeared into one of the inner rooms. On their way out, though, the flashlights they carried had briefly illuminated the stranger against the wall. His face was bruised, and he looked as though he were tied to the chair, just like Daniel was. When the door shut behind their captors, he finally spoke. "Are you really Daniel Jackson?"
Yeah, I am.
Who?
"Well, it's about bloody time," the stranger interrupted him. "I have no idea what's going on here. My green card's in order. My show's premiering in less than 24 hours. And for the love of God, I don't even know what the initials NID stand for. So would you please do me a favor and tell these thugs that you've never seen me before in your life?"
Though Los Angeles was burning, the news didn't seem to have reached West Hollywood. The bars along the north side of Santa Monica Boulevard were all open, candles flickering on tables, music blasting from battery-powered boomboxes. The sidewalks were crammed shoulder to shoulder with self-consciously beautiful men holding drinks and each other, spilling out into the gridlock traffic, laughing and shouting. A boy with blonde hair and a mesh muscle shirt draped himself over the back door of the Plymouth and pushed a bottle of Sam Adams into Jack's hand.
"There's no more ice," he told Jack mournfully. "We'll just have to drink it all now."
"Thanks anyway," Jack tried to say, but the boy kissed Jack's face beerily, stroked his cheek with the hand that wasn't holding his own bottle, and then melted away into the crowd.
"Robertson's only a couple blocks away," Angel said. "I could make it to the theater faster on foot."
He proceeded to inch the car up onto the sidewalk, despite the noisy but mostly ineffectual protests of the people coming out of the bars, then turned off the ignition and handed the keys to Wesley.
"I'm going to go get Cordelia. Looks like you and Jack will be all right until I get back."
"Yes," Wesley agreed, looking around himself with bemusement. "I believe the only thing in danger here is our virtue."
Paul Davis had seen the aerial surveillance from P3X-636, so at least he recognized the place. Unfortunately, simply knowing where he was didn't help much. For a fleeting instant, he remembered this couldn't be real. They were in Santa Monica, they were having dinner, and there was no way they could suddenly be on the other side of the galaxy. Then Tilk stumbled to his knees beside Paul, and in front of him, Major Carter sprawled on her side, one arm flung outward, and her fingers digging into the earth as though she were trying to keep herself from falling off the planet. Paul raised his eyes and forgot all about Santa Monica and Indian food and the pale ale that had been sloshing in his glass moments before. The ruins were monumental, their broken shapes blotting out a third of the sky. There was something so fundamentally wrong about them, Paul couldn't force his mind to grasp what he was seeing. Objects seemed to be growing larger as they receded into the distance, and lacking the barest rudiments of perspective, he felt as though he were tumbling forward into an endless void. He didn't realize he'd actually fallen until he bruised his knees and elbows on the wet sand. Paul closed his eyes. He wanted to call for the others, but nausea choked him, and he could feel the icy lump of his heart splintering with every contraction.
When he finally opened his eyes again, his head was turned to the side, left cheek against the ground. He could see the sand clinging to his own eyelashes, blurred suggestions of shape in the impossibly near distance, and he could see a gray plain of wet sand stretching away from him. Marring the expanse of sand and tatters of dried seafoam was a line of naked footprints. Though Paul desperately didn't want to, he raised himself onto his elbows and strained to see who was leaving footsteps behind. Blair Sandberg was walking alone into the ruins. He didn't waver or stumble, not even when the horizon itself heaved upward and began to stretch toward the stars. The next thing Paul knew, he was a hair's breadth from stepping into a lane of traffic. He stumbled backwards, arms cartwheeling to keep himself from falling. When he was safely on the sidewalk, he turned in a dazed circle, trying to figure out where he was and what had happened. Dark buildings crowded closely on either side of a busy road. The power was out, car horns and alarms were blaring into the night, and the sky was full of stars.
"Major Carter," he shouted. "Tilk!"
People were crying out all around him, and he doubted anyone heard him.
"Detective Ellison!"
He took a few stumbling steps up the sidewalk, thinking he recognized the black shape of a building at the next corner as the Indian restaurant where they'd been having a late dinner about a million years ago.
"Dr. Sandberg!"
"Right here, man," said a hoarse, shaking voice right beside him.
"You okay?"
Paul turned his head. The headlights from passing cars backlit Blair Sandberg's loose mane of hair like a halo.
"I'm all right," Paul said, his own voice none too steady. "God, it beats the hell out of me. Have you seen Jim? I was looking for him in that place."
His voice broke.
"What the hell was that?"
He pressed his palms against his forehead as if he were trying to hold his brains in.
"I know you don't know either, and you wouldn't tell me if you did. It's making me crazy the way you people expect Jim to help you, and you won't even..."
Paul took his arm and pointed up the street. "I think that's the Raj, just a block away. Everyone else may still be there." Stark relief replaced the frustration on Blair's face.
"You're right," he said, and immediately darted off through the crowd, Paul scrambling to stay close.
The people around them were stumbling about in a daze, clinging to each other, shouting and crying. Then Paul heard a scream from the other side of the street and the screech of brakes, and he looked around in time to see a car suddenly plowing across the sidewalk to crash into a storefront. Instantly, a crowd formed around the car, screams becoming shouts. By the strobe of passing headlights, Paul caught glimpses of the driver being dragged from the car.
"They're going to kill him," Blair exclaimed in horror.
He took a step towards the street before Paul caught him and pulled him back.
"We can't help."
Blair struggled furiously to pull free.
"We can't just stand here."
Paul forcibly turned him around. "Dr. Sandberg, we wouldn't even make it across the street. Those cars aren't stopping for anyone." Blair stopped fighting. Paul loosened his grip, and Blair angrily shook himself free. But after a long moment, he turned away and didn't try again to cross.
"We've got to find Jim."
"Dr. Sandberg?"
A man seemed to materialize out of the crowd at Blair's side.
"I need for you to come with me right away."
What? Blair looked back at Paul.
Frightened, confused people surged around them.
Who are you?
Alarms wailed monotonously, and the red and blue lights of emergency vehicles and police cars had begun reflecting off the glass storefronts. Paul tried to push his way through to Blair, but someone was blocking his path.
Dr. Sandberg, Blair!
I need to take you to Detective Ellison, Paul heard the stranger telling Blair. There isn't much time.
Jim? Has something happened to Jim?
Blair craned his head back in Paul's direction.
Paul, do you know this guy?
That's far enough, Major. Someone swung him around, and Paul found himself face to face with a man he recognized.
Agent Katz, he said in astonishment.
The man was NID, stationed in D.C.
What are you doing here? What's going on?
With all due respect, this is nothing you want to be involved in, Major Davis. Now's the time for you to turn around and just walk away.
What?
Agent, I need to talk to the senior officer on the scene immediately. Blair suddenly cried out in pain or anger. Paul pushed his way around Agent Katz and saw two men dragging Blair towards a parked sedan.
What do you think you're doing? Paul shouted.
Neither of Blair's assailants even looked back at him. They pushed Blair down over the hood of the car, cuffing and frisking him, while other people on the crowded sidewalk paid no attention at all, or simply gave them a wide berth. When they pulled Blair upright again, he wasn't fighting anymore. He swung his head around to find Paul in the crowd.
"These your people, too?" he asked dully.
"No, Dr. Sandberg, I'm going to get to the bottom of this right now. They're not taking you anywhere."
"Last chance, Major."
Agent Katz pulled his weapon and put the muzzle squarely against Paul's chest. Paul looked down at the SIG, and then at the man wielding it, in utter astonishment. This was insane.
Of course it was, he thought then, remembering the phantom airman last night who'd invaded Jim and Blair's home, then disappeared like all the rest of the night's hallucinations.
They must still be trapped in a dream. None of this is real.
Get out of my way, Paul said, and pushed Katz aside.
Something exploded at very close range. Paul felt the blow like a kick in the chest. He tried to take another step toward Blair, but his feet were as heavy as lead. He could hardly lift them. His peripheral vision began to gray, but he saw Blair Sandberg's mouth moving, and he looked as though he were very angry, shouting something that Paul couldn't hear.
Dr. Sandberg, he said,
and was unhappy to discover that talking hurt. It hurt as much as breathing did. No one caught him when he fell.